This is Writing Lessons, and I'm your host, Silas House. In each episode of Writing Lessons, we look at a different topic of creative writing, and today we're focusing on the business of writing, how we manage our time, how we make a living, how to submit, and how to devote ourselves to a life of art. I've asked one of my favorite writers to join us for this episode, Rebecca Gale Howe, who certainly understands what it means to strike that balance. On this podcast, we are trying to supply writers with free lessons, and so far we've covered topics like characterization, what makes a great poem, how to write a picture book, creating dynamic plots, and more. But something we don't talk enough about as writers is how artists make a living, and more specifically, how we strike the balance of making a living and making art that is not dictated by that. So that's what we'll be looking at today. Howe is the author of poetry collections such as Render and Apocalypse, which was a best-selling book of the decade for small press distribution, and American Purgatory, recipient of the Sexton Prize. For many years, she was the poetry editor for Oxford American magazine. A native of Lexington, she now teaches poetry and translation in the University of Arkansas's MFA program.
Well, one thing that has always bonded us, I think, is being raised working class. Unlike a lot of people in the literary world, neither of us come from any kind of family money, and we've always had to work, and we've always had to strike that balance of making a living and making art. So just hearing me say that, what are some of your thoughts or responses to that?
Well, it's absolutely true that that's part of our deep bond. I think that, you know, well, I'll say this. I think we're two of the lucky ones, you know? Mm-hmm. I think about a lot of working class people who could be brilliant artists and haven't been able to figure out how to just make it all work. Right. And, you know, I just feel really lucky. You know, I'm not sure that I have a lot of the answers, but I've just kept my shoulder to the plow like you have, and, you know, just every day do something more. And I think that, you know, I wonder if this is true for you. Part of my story is that my mom, who's from Buckhorn, left her holler when she was 15 and had to start working then. And she had to start working then because her parents couldn't afford books for school anymore. Mm. And she loves to read. You know, mm-hmm. And I think often about how, and she's always operating in story. And I think often about how she might have really been a great novelist. You know, mm-hmm. if she'd been able to have a different relationship with time. And so, you know, I believe in the transformational power of art, and I think you do too. You know, absolutely. For community, for the soul. For how we relate to each other and the power of empathy. And that just keeps me going.
Me too. It really has surprised me in my 20 some years of being a published writer of how moneyed the literary world is.
Yeah.
And how often I find myself in rooms with people that don't have the same sense of reality that I do about work, you know?
Right.
I think that's important for people to know about the literary world. And so it's a reason I always talk about being working class, mm-hmm. and how I'm thankful to have been raised that way. And it certainly taught me a lot about work ethic that is still really important to my process as a writer. But it also is frustrating sometimes, those obstacles that come before you. And of course, one of those is just finding enough time to write. I always tell my students that's the number one thing that I have to fight for is more time to write. How do you manage time? What kind of time manager are you? And you must be a really great one because you balance so many things.
Well, first of all, I want to circle back to what you just said. Like, I think it is really important, and I do that too, just speak the truth about being working class. I think because of the reality of how well-funded so many writers are, but also because I think you and I, by modeling that, create a permission structure to imagine, you know, that possibility for people who might be with us, you know, for themselves. So I think that I think that the first thing about what you're asking me about right now is also just like the imagination of one's own life and how to harness possibility for yourself and not be afraid to do that. I think that when you really have to struggle for every single dollar, for every single hour, it can be kind of scary to imagine possibility.
Yes.
It's almost like it's getting above your raising, like who are you, right?
Absolutely.
Right. So I think that that's a really important place to start. Yeah, I got a PhD in work ethic from my parents, and I can say more about that in a minute, but that has been really, really important to my life as an artist. And time management is a piece of that. I was talking to my grad students here in Arkansas last night about this actually, and one of them had said how much they were frustrated because they were not being asked for new work in a situation. And I just found myself saying, you ask yourself for that work. And
Right.
so, like we the secret that nobody really says is that we sort of have to become our own best teachers, editors, deadline keepers, I think that there is an intrinsic motivation, what is sometimes called a calling to the art. That if you really do listen to it'll get you up off the couch. No one's going to be waiting for you to finish this novel, right? And we love your novels, but no one's fin waiting for you to do that. You've got to believe in the transformational power of that story to dedicate time every day to that, to telling that story and to telling it in as well a way as you can, so that it can live on its own well past you, right? And so, yeah, I work really hard all the time. I am really serious about dedicating particular hours in my day to my reading and writing practices. And I think you do this too, right? Like you set your own deadlines. And I work as an editor, you work as an editor. We know what it's like to sit in that chair, and I just play a little game with myself and be like, okay, this is due this day, and it does help.
This is a little off topic, but it's a writing lesson. Two or three times now you've said the word imagination, and I tell my students all the time that that's one of the most important words that we can think about as artists, as writers. And I don't think it gets talked about enough. And I mean, it's just, I think, I don't know, maybe people think it's just so obvious that we're using our imaginations that we don't need to talk about it more. But I also find that a lot of beginning writers don't know to draw on the imagination more.
Yeah, I've been finding that too. And of course, we could have a whole hour-long conversation around how information processing has so dramatically changed the human mind in the time that you and I have been just like working as writers, but I think that when I'm teaching, I often talk about the imaginative intelligence, right? And how do you, because it's not I don't believe in talent. Like you're not born an artist, right? Like we learn how to do it. Like you learn how to ride a bike, like you learn how to be a great basketball player, we learn how to do it. And educating your imagination and learning how to activate it in a way that can surprise you as you work, right? I'm never more excited about what I'm writing when, unless it's like something's happening that I didn't expect, when the characters start talking to me and telling me what they want to be, right?
Exactly.
That's a kind of intelligence. And if we begin to frame it for ourselves that way, I think that the value of arts education, the dialogue around that sort of changes, right? Because what we're really talking about is the capacity to imagine someone else's life.
Well, you are known as a transformational teacher.
Well,
I know both of us, I know, love our students so deeply. But it also goes back to that time factor. How does being a teacher feed you as an artist? And how does it drain you as an artist?
I love teaching. I know you do too. And I wonder if this is true for you. It is for me that it, gosh, it's just such a privilege, but it becomes this ecosystem of sharing, you know, where when I look back over my career as a teacher, I think, oh, that person was my teacher. That student was my teacher. That student was my teacher. That, right? And I know it's an adage, but it really is true. Like they give us so much more than we could ever give them. And so I'm really grateful always, always. I feel like it's an immense privilege to be in those conversations. And I'm passionate about it because of, you know, the story I just told about my mom and how deeply that takes seed in me. So when I'm teaching writers, it's a circle of giving, and I'm very grateful. And my students so often are breaking their ground, are doing work that is surprising to them, right? And then that helps me to imagine something new for my own practice, you know? And so there's that piece to it too. How it takes away is, well, there's two answers to this. The first is, I think, probably pretty obvious, right? Like when you're nurturing writers, there's such a one-to-one ratio of mentoring that runs so deep. And this has to do with how languages are learned. You know, if just think about language acquisition for a minute, if you're learning a second or a third language, fluency goes way up if the person who's teaching you, if there's a low student teacher ratio, and the lower it gets, the higher fluency raises, right? And so that's true with what you and I do too, right? And so when I'm teaching, when I'm really mentoring apprenticing writers, I try to go as one-on-one as I possibly can for that reason, right? But I mean, you do that 10 times, right? And your energy gets pretty thin.
Well, a question I get a lot from writers is, should I obtain an MFA or not? I have a response that I really believe in that I go immediately to. What is your response to that question?
Sure, I'm eager to hear yours, but my response is, well, one, only you know what's best for you, writer who's asking me, right? The MFA system is relatively new, right? And the best part of that story is that it was a democratizing force. You know, to circle back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, if you didn't have money before that, there was almost no chance you were gonna be able to build a life of time and contemplation and production. Let alone just even getting the mentoring you needed. The apprenticeship itself, which in poetry, I always tell my students is around 7 years long of concentrated study. You know, who buys that? Right? If your mom and daddy aren't buying it. So the MFA system did a lot to make way for people like you and me. You know, the institution allowed for that time to be bought on some level, enough for you to, you know, for me to get enough traction in my practice that I could carry it out on my own the rest of the way. So that's valuable. And I do think that it, you know, I can only speak about, you know, poetry and literary translation, but I do think it's at least 7 years long. It takes really substantial, dedicated hours of reading and writing. It's kinesthetic learning. You have to do to learn, right? And if an institution can buy those years for you, great. It's not the only way. And I think the other thing that you and I really have in common is that the Kentucky literary community really gave us an apprenticeship before either one of us went and did MFAs. You had your t community teachers, I had mine. We share some of them, Wendell being one of them, And we come from this culture in Kentucky that is, and I speak about this often when I'm on the lecture circuit. I think you do too, right? Like it is on the national scene, it is unique.
Yeah, it is.
We came up in a culture where our elders taught us because art is sacred. So let's go.
It wasn't about, there was no transaction. It was just passing it on.
Yeah, this is about community. This is about cultural memory, land memory, about neighborliness and about the transcendent capacity for the imagination. So, I think often about how to continue that as arts education is moving in the direction it's in.
Yeah, I tell people exactly what you're saying. It depends on the writer. I think, some people have come to me and talked to me about that, and I've said, sounds like you're ready for an MFA, go for it. Other people, I'm like, maybe you should just take the money that you would have to spend on that and take a trip or, go into solitude or whatever. I think that everybody's different. I've felt transformed by my MFA experience.
Me too.
However, I happened to do it at the right time in my life. I had been out of, I had done my undergrad like almost 10 years before. I had 10 years of, living and working really hard jobs and et cetera, real life, life experience that became important to me. Then I got my MFA and had that different experience. Some people, can go straight from getting their undergrad, getting their bachelor's, and go right in the MFA program. That would not have worked for me. So a lot of it is about timing, I think.
Yeah. I mean, if an undergrad is asking me for my advice is pretty consistently go do something else for a minute. Be grown when you go do this thing if you're going to go do it. It matters. Life experience matters to a writer.
Yes. Well, one thing that I find to be a real time-sucking chore that I hate, but I have to do is submitting my work to publications and such. I mean, we have to do it. So for years, you were the poetry editor at Oxford American. You've done other editing, other things, involved in the submission process. You've submitted yourself. Is there something? Are there tips you can give to people for more successful submitting to publications? My main one would be read the submission guidelines.
Yes.
Save yourself some time.
Yeah, it's tough out there, and I think I love the mission of this podcast. I love imagining who we're talking to right now. It can be especially tough, as you and I both know, for writers in rural communities, right? Because the other, secret truth about the literary world on the national scale is that it is very centered in New York and LA and power brokering. And so it can be really hard to open those doors for reasons having nothing to do with the quality of the work, right? And so I would wanna I always try to be really transparent about that because my first piece of advice is write through your own truth and joy and write something that you want to stand beside 10 years from now, Develop your own sense of integrity and aesthetic, and then work hard at that, so that whoever publishes it, it's been on those terms. That said, it can, in a really practical way, it can be very, very hard to succeed through the slush pile. I have seen behind the scenes, I think you probably have too, where slush piles are open and money is charged and the slush pile is never even read, right? Like not ethical things happen. So The other thing that I often say in these conversations, for all of these reasons that we're sketching out, is, what does it look like to publish to your neighbors? What magazines are at work in your community, in your nearby community, in your region, in your state? And that's, again, that goes back to that incredible inheritance you and I have, right? Kentucky really has a kind of literary economy that's for us by us. That's really rare and special. But that has taught me a lot. And now when I'm in many other kinds of communities, I say, who's publishing in this town? Who's publishing in this county? Have you ever gotten to know them? And that's the third piece of advice I always give. Don't believe in, I'm kind of terrible at networking, but I believe in relationship. And that matters.
What I tell students about networking is that to me, networking has to me, networking has to be genuine. It
That's
can't
what you're
be, I'm talking to this person just because I want to get published in their magazine. It has to be, I'm interested in them as a human being,
Right.
except it has to be a real relationship, or I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And I think that's what I hear you saying, just in like, read the submission guidelines, read the magazine, read books that the imprint is putting out. I think of Kaveh Akbar and his wonderful example. When he was first coming up as a poet, what did he do? He launched an interview series with poets who he had loved and admired, and we just wanted to get to know, and he did that before he ever released, years before he ever released his first book. So yeah, I think we're saying the same thing, one, write to your own integrity, your own sense of beauty and aesthetic and truth, and build meaningful relationships.
I think that stereotype that writers operate in solitude and all that has been harmful. Of course, on one hand, we are, creating poems and novels and such on our own, but I think you really need a community to lean on during that, to trade information, but mostly to trade encouragement and belief in each other and all that. It has to be a loving community.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a different kind of work that we do, meaning, it's not easily recognizable by people who haven't participated in it, who don't have family members who participate in the arts. And it can be really lonesome in that way. Like, am I wasting my time? People often say that to me, is this just a waste of my time? Should I be going off and doing this other thing, And having a good community behind you that says, no, this is meaningful for your life, and so therefore it's valuable.
What are the ceremonies that are important to you as a writer?
I am a serious meditator. I meditate twice a day, and I think that indicates that I am interested in repeating contemplation. And so, one thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately as a teacher is the role of neuroplasticity and creative intelligence, and how we learn how to be artists and what repeats repeats, So when I'm working, I show up at my desk at the same time of day for an extended period of time, at least an hour. At least an hour for my writing practice, at least an hour for my reading practice. And I make sure that I'm doing both, and I can explain why if that's useful. But I try to do that at the same time of day for an extended period of day, both kinds of practice. And before I go to sleep at night, I will read what I'm writing, what I wrote that day, so that I can sleep on it, so that my nighttime mind can background process it. And when I wake up in the next morning, oftentimes if I'm stuck on a poem, it will have unraveled itself over the night, So there are habits that I have that are ceremonial in the sense that I keep them with reverence.
So my last question, what is the best writing lesson you've ever learned?
When I was at the Fine Arts Work Center the first time, I knew Carolyn Frischet a little bit, but she came and stayed with us, and she and I got to be quite close during that time. And the advice she gave me then is the best advice I've ever gotten, which is read a book of poems a day. And she said, go to the library, grab 7 books on Sunday. It does not matter which books they are. And read one a day. Don't be precious about it. Don't be fussy about it. Right. And I did that. And it was absolutely transformational for my practice and for my relationship with language. I did it for 9 months. Anytime anyone who's listening to us could give themselves even 1 month of doing that, I promise you, it will be electrifying for your practice. And I've gone on to teach that method and seen it, witnessed it in other people's practices. And the only thing I know to say is that I think I have a master's degree in linguistics. And so I think a lot about how just language happens in the brain and what that has to do with what we're talking about today. And if you want to be fluent in a language, immersion is the path forward. And when we read, we're practicing a kind of immersion learning when we read literature.
Well, thank you so much. I admire you so much as a writer and a teacher and a person in so many ways. So thank you for all that you do.
Right back at you.
Writing Lessons is an initiative of the 2024-2025 Kentucky Poet Laureate. That's me, Silas House. I'm thankful for the support of the Kentucky Arts Council, the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, the Office of Governor Andy Beshear, and Kentucky Humanities. This show is written, recorded, edited, and produced by me. I hope you will share the show with other writers, students, or anyone who is interested in the creative process. Please subscribe to our show, and if you like it, I hope you'll leave a review or a 5-star rating. That'll help us get the show to more listeners. Thanks so much for listening to Writing Lessons.